no-cost grain exports? Is Russia looking to help feed hungry Africans or its own coffers?
It wants to help itself, and this is just a cover for that. And it's going to position itself to make a lot of money off these African countries with its bumper harvest this year.
Plus, the impact on education with hundreds of Ukrainian schools damaged or destroyed.
Across Ukraine, millions of children's educations have been disrupted. Millions more children have fled the country, and more than 500 have been killed.
And a pilot project in Peru that's using a robot to plant seeds to help reforestation of the Amazon. Today is Friday, July 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning, I'm Lori London in Washington. Russia began hosting a two-day summit of African countries Thursday as world tensions grew due to an increase in food prices following Moscow's withdrawal from the grain shipment agreement signed with Ukraine and Turkey. In hosting the gathering, Russia is looking to cast its image as a partner of the African continent with fresh offerings, it says, will help with food security. Marcus Harton narrates this report from the VOA Moscow Bureau.
African delegations arrive in St. Petersburg for a summit overshadowed by the war in Ukraine and Russia's efforts to mitigate its isolation. 17 heads of state joined this meeting, 18 fewer than the last summit 4 years ago in Sochi. Moscow accuses Washington of pressuring Africans not to attend the summit, where President Putin on Thursday promised substantial direct aid to the continent. He said, "I am ready to grant at no charge from 25 to 50,000 tons of grain to Burkina Faso, Zimbabwe, Mali, Somalia, the Central African Republic, and Eritrea in the coming months, in the next 3 to 4 months." Russia called the summit as world tensions grow due to an increase in food prices following Moscow's withdrawal from the grain shipment agreements it had signed with Ukraine and Turkey. Bashir Abbasakola heads the Nigerians in Diaspora Organization Europe.
It's very, very important because Russia is known for that fertilizer relation, because supplying of fertilizer to African countries from Russia is...
But there is agreement on little else, and some at the gathering were preparing to call on Russia to halt its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Of all the participants, Abbasakola says only Russia appears interested in continuing the war. Many in the West see the two-day summit as a propaganda move by the Kremlin to show that it is not cut off from the world. But observers say it is also an opportunity to speak frankly with Russian leaders on the need to bring peace to Ukraine. For the VOA Moscow Bureau, Marcus Harton, VOA News.
As Russia seeks to boost its influence in Africa, where nations across the continent are contending with conflict, drought, and food insecurity, which side actually stands to benefit from closer ties? I put the question to Daniel Speckhard, former ambassador to Belarus and the current CEO of Chorus International, a group of global humanitarian assistance nonprofits.
I think Russia's interests here are to show that it's not isolated in the world, that it still has many friends, and reaching out to Africa is a way that it can kind of cover a lot of countries and show ties that it can't find in the rest of the world, who's kind of started to isolate it from its conflict in Ukraine. Russia certainly benefits a lot more from these right now. About five times, African countries import five times more than they export to Russia. So it's actually economically good for Russia. It exports grain, oil, and other things. So this is important for Russia's economy at a time, whether it's under a lot of stress from sanctions, and it's trying to find ways to build itself up. It's also angry, right? It's just lashing out and reacting to the way the war is going against it in Ukraine and what happened in the recent coup. So it's now trying to reach out and reposition itself and make itself look strong. So it's pounding on the Ukraine, both in terms of its targets of civilian populations, but then it's trying to cut off its exports of grain, which is part of the economic livelihood of Ukraine.
Putin is promising a no-cost cost donation, basically, of Russian grain to six African countries. He said Russian grain can replace Ukrainian grain imports. Can that compensate for the impact of Russia cutting off grain exports from Ukraine? The UN Secretary General certainly doesn't think so.
Yeah, these are tiny little symbolic gestures, which I'm sure are welcomed by these countries. But 25 to 50,000 tons for a country like Burkina Faso is just a tiny fraction of its imports. It imports roughly 850,000 tons of cereal imports, including wheat, a year. So this is just really a drop in the bucket. And it's looking actually to sell grain to Africa in a year where it's going to have a very good harvest. So it's looking to economically benefit from all these African countries. And this is just kind of like one of those little things you get a little teaser to say, here's a little benefit, now buy the rest from us. So this is going to be to Russia's benefit in the end. If they can cut off more Ukrainian exports, prices stay higher and they have plenty to export. But this is not something to be seen as a humanitarian gesture. Russia benefits tremendously from these attacks on Ukrainian grain. And it's not just an attempt for the security situation in the war to kind of destabilize Ukraine and weaken Ukraine's financial situation and infrastructure, but it's also to position themselves economically better, getting more money from countries who have to import their grains, improving their financial situation, and the notion that they're giving away gifts will be more than made up many fold times by keeping prices higher in the world grain market. So they stand to benefit tremendously from this, and the rest of the world will suffer.
Will these African leaders have any influence of their own on Mr. Putin to try to get him to get back into the Black Sea grain deal?
I think they will privately and diplomatically try to pressure them to get back in because it's very important for them. But they're going to be very careful not to stand out because each country is very small. Together, they actually represent something much more significant. And I didn't think it was insignificant that the head of the African Union at this summit stated that he would like to see peaceful coexistence between Russia and Ukraine. It's a sensitive topic to bring up, but the fact that he did meant how important this is to these countries. This is really still significant for many of them on this world grain supply gets tightened up by cutting off Ukraine. Ukraine provides roughly 10%, I believe, of the world's wheat and 15% of the world's corn. So it has an impact.
What are you seeing as far as the drought and hunger and food insecurity issues across Africa and the impact that pulling out of the grain deal is potentially already having and will continue to have? And now, of course, with Russia blowing up Ukrainian ports.
I think what you have to notice on this is it's always the poorest, most vulnerable populations that suffer the most when these strategic, geostrategic things happen. And it's going to be the case this time. When you talk about basic foodstuffs, you talk about trying to restrict literally tens of millions of tons of grain going into the world. Much of that goes to East Africa, where there is an acute food insecurity situation right now, with really tens of millions of people facing severe food insecurity. Just in the last 6 months or so, food prices have gone up by 40% for many of these populations that are now out of the reach of many families. There's literally malnutrition, severe hunger, and in some cases, starvation happening in these countries. So this is not just something where prices go up and everybody survives and the rest of the world figures out how to handle the humanitarian crisis. The World Food Program cannot already feed the people that need to be fed in the humanitarian situation. So we have a crisis on the humanitarian side. So for this to happen right now, this is politically unconscionable. And people are literally facing starvation in some of these East African countries to say we don't need these extra imports from Ukraine. Is a moral crisis.
Daniel Speckhard, former ambassador to Belarus and currently the CEO of Chorus International, a group of global humanitarian assistance nonprofits. As fierce fighting continues, Russian forces struck more port infrastructure in Ukraine's Odessa region in an overnight missile attack Thursday, killing a security guard and damaging a cargo terminal. And since Russia's invasion, thousands of schools have been damaged and hundreds destroyed in Ukraine. And for many students living near the battle zones, getting an education has become a near impossibility. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports with Yevheny Shinkar in Liman, Ukraine.
Every school in the city of Liman, Ukraine has been damaged, and many are destroyed. This school was hit before the city was captured by Russia in May 2022, and it has remained shut down since Ukraine took the city back 4 months later.
Over here, we ran long and short distances for gym class. Here we played football. On the second floor was a cafeteria. On the first floor was an assembly room.
We had assemblies there.
In the basement, we had industrial arts and health classes.
Now, as the battles once again approach Liman, with an attack killing 8 civilians in early July, students say they are facing yet another year of the online education that began with pandemic lockdowns. Local leaders say volunteers provide some supplies and internet links.
They are not enough, but they provided us with laptops, tablets, printers, and stationery items. But it was very, very difficult.
But students say supplies are useless when battles draw near, as the internet is down or only available in hospitals or military bases. The Ukrainian government says thousands of schools have been damaged in the war, and hundreds are destroyed. Studying online under these conditions is better than no education at all, but just barely, says Zakhar. Other students tell us they are forgetting more from their in-person school days than they are currently learning. In Liman, there are just over 500 children struggling to get an education, as most families have long fled the area. Across Ukraine, millions of children's educations have been disrupted. Millions more children have fled the country, and more than 500 have been killed. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Liman, Ukraine.
U.S. officials say the removal of Chinese Foreign Minister Qin Gang will not slow efforts to improve dialogue between the two countries, even as the U.S. Congress advances legislation that slows U.S. investment in Chinese technology. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson wraps up the week in U.S.-China news.
Drills on Bali Beach in Taipei City. The week beginning with Taiwan's annual exercise, preparing for a possible attack from China.
Today's anti-landing combat exercise is the largest exercise this year, testing the cooperation among different services, units, and forces.
Then on Tuesday, Chinese state television announced Foreign Minister Qin Gang would be replaced with his predecessor, Wang Yi, after just 7 months in that post. The United States saying Qin's removal will not change recent efforts by high-level officials to maintain the U.S.-China dialogue.
It is important for us to manage this relationship responsibly. That starts with diplomacy, that starts with engaging, and I will work with whoever the relevant Chinese counterpart is.
But in the U.S. Congress, concerns about U.S. economic competition with China remain high.
We are not controlling cutting-edge technology anymore. We're all but giving it away in many cases. We have a bucket with massive holes in the bottom, and we continue to pour billions and billions of R&D dollars into that bucket every year.
As part of its debate over the massive annual defense spending bill, the U.S. Senate advanced several key measures this week, requiring U.S. companies to report investment in Chinese technologies, such as semiconductors and artificial intelligence, a move condemned by China.
The nature of China-U.S. economic and trade cooperation is mutual benefit and win-win outcome. Intentionally restricting or interfering with normal economic, trade, and investment activities in the industry and in the private sector is contrary to the principles of market economy.
But a Pew Research survey released Thursday found unfavorable views of China worldwide, with 71% of adults surveyed saying China does not contribute to global peace and stability. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Donald Trump faced new charges Thursday in a case accusing him of illegally possessing classified documents, with prosecutors alleging that he asked a staffer to delete camera footage at his Florida estate in an effort to obstruct a federal investigation. A wildfire has triggered a series of massive explosions at an Air Force ammunition depot in central Greece. Fires have raged across parts of the country during three consecutive Mediterranean heat waves in the past 2 weeks. A system of ocean currents that transports heat northward across the North Atlantic could collapse by mid-century, according to a new study. Scientists have said that such a collapse could cause a catastrophic rise in sea levels and extreme weather across the globe. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
The European Space Agency's Aeolus satellite has been in orbit for 5 years, 2 years past its planned mission of monitoring wind activity on Earth. With its fuel supply nearly exhausted, the spacecraft, affected by Earth's gravity, atmosphere, and solar activity, began falling from its normal orbit on June 19th. Instead of letting it deorbit naturally, the space agency is performing a first-of-its-kind assisted re-entry entry of the defunct spacecraft. ESA's intervention began on July 24th with a series of maneuvers to steer its descent. Final commands will be sent to the satellite on July 28th. When it reaches 80 kilometers above Earth, it's expected most of the spacecraft will begin to burn up as it travels through the atmosphere. Any remaining debris has been targeted to fall in a remote area of the Atlantic Ocean. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. Niger's president defiantly declared that democracy would prevail a day after mutinous soldiers detained him and announced they had seized power in a coup. Analysts say the apparent coup attempt was not totally surprising, given the West African nation's history of political upheaval. VOA Nairobi chief Mariama Diallo brings us this report.
In their address to the nation, the head of the mutiny, Colonel Amadou Abdrahman, said that defense and security forces toppled the government due to bad governance and to the security situation in Niger. On Thursday, all activities by political parties in the country had been suspended until further notice. Democratically elected President Mohamed Bazoum took the oath of office in April 2021. Dr. Edgar Githua, an international relations and diplomacy expert teaching at the U.S. International University in Nairobi, told VOA the latest political unrest was not unexpected.
This is a country that has endured four coups in its history. So the political culture in Niger is that I think the military feeling very entitled or have been enabled to feel like they really need to play a role in politics.
Githua says President Bazoum's ethnic background could be another possible reason.
He's a Difa Arab and he came from a minority group. He came in and was making lots of changes because he inherited a country that had the bigger ethnic groups within Niger. And normally what happens for such presidents who inherit constituencies where they are not where they are, they come from a minority, they feel, for lack of a better word, they feel like they're under siege because you're inheriting a system where you are in the minority and the other people who control government are from other ethnic groups who believe or do not feel you deserve to lead them.
The West African Economic Bloc, ECOWAS, the African Union, and others in the international community have condemned the events in Niger, in a region that has recently seen a wave of coups. In Mali, Burkina Faso, and Guinea, Niger has been able to hold on to democratic stability since Bazoum came to power. Al-Kassoum says this coup attempt, if successful, could affect the whole region.
Niger said,
if Niger falls, it's all ECOWAS that falls, and all the Sahel that falls. And if we're not careful the same way, the other countries with military dictatorships have fallen into total insecurity.
Niger, located in the Sahel region, has been battling Islamist militants, and France, which has been helping in that fight, has about 1,500 soldiers there. Githua says he does not think this coup attempt will stick.
The European Union, the U.S., and France will not let Niger go down. This is their bastion of hope in the region in containing the excessive incursions and rebellions and terrorism and Al-Qaeda's activities in that region, Boko Haram and the likes. The U.S. already has troops stationed in Niger. There are special forces, around 1,000. These ones will rally behind the people.
Bazoum supporters on Wednesday gathered in front of the National Assembly building to call for his release. But on Thursday, others demonstrated in favor of the purchase. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
A pilot project in Peru is using a robot to plant seeds to help reforestation of the Amazon, where pristine rainforest and biodiversity is being blighted by mining and logging, much of it illegal. From Reuters, Flora Bradley Watson has more.
Could this seed-planting robot be key to saving the Amazon rainforest? Known as Yumi and created by ABB Robotics, it can sow about 600 seeds in a morning's work, the equivalent of 2 football fields in a day. Conservationists say it could be a potential game-changer in efforts to preserve the world's largest rainforest in the face of illegal mining and logging.
As of right now, we have lost 20% of the total land in the Amazon rainforest.
Mohsin Kazmi is the CEO of the non-profit organization Jungle Keepers, which is part of a pilot project in Peru trialing the use of the robot.
We're truly just protecting the thousands, if not millions, of heartbeats that exist in this mega biodiverse ecosystem.
Jungle Keepers took 3 days to transport the robot up the Las Piedras River to their base deep in the jungle in southeastern Peru. Once in place, the robot can work all day, carefully picking up seeds and using a trowel to move the soil. It's powered by solar panels and connected by solar satellite Wi-Fi for remote updates from an ABB base in Sweden.
This robot is incredibly agile, and it's able to plant all of our seeds for our nursery, freeing up our rangers to do other tasks involving the reforestation project itself. The robot is able to remove soil and plant seeds all in one box, 16 at a time.
Jungle Keepers is exploring setting up larger scale robot planting facilities in local communities, which would potentially allow thousands of seeds to be planted daily. But they face an uphill struggle in their efforts. Here's why. Last year alone, about 3 football fields worth of virgin forest was cleared every minute, according to government data from Brazil. The deforestation is largely fueled by illegal gold mining and logging, as well as forest clearance to plant coca crops, the raw ingredient for cocaine.
So many loggers every day. You can't imagine how many trees goes.
Jungle Keepers' Vice President Juan Julio Durand Torres is all too familiar with the issue. He used to be an illegal miner and logger himself and says it's important to use new technology and engage with the local community.
The mining, the logger, they do have, at this point, they have advanced technology. They can destroy so much. So if we have robots here to help planting trees and local people be involved and learning technology, it'll be like pretty much battling together. This is a good aim for us.
That report from Reuters correspondent Flora Bradley Watson. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, we thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Be safe and have a wonderful weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It is not uncommon for the United States and the People's Republic of China to stand on opposing sides of many an issue. But when it comes to climate change, the two countries agree that it is a global existential threat. As the world's two biggest greenhouse gas emitters, they must address the problem together.
We agreed to work together towards ambitious and agreed outcomes at COP28, at the IMO, ICAO, at the Montreal Protocol, and in other international fora. And we both committed to make best efforts to try to keep 1.5 degrees as the limit of the warming, to keep that within reach.
The intensity and sense of urgency has grown for everybody, said Special Envoy Kerry. I think China is greatly seized by this issue.
China has produced more renewable energy, more solar and wind than any other country in the world. They have deployed more than the rest of the world put together. And they are pursuing a very aggressive renewable strategy to try to ultimately reduce their emissions.
Nonetheless, the fact remains that China has continued to build new coal plants. But if the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement are to be met, all coal-fired plants must cease operations by 2040, and no new ones can come online. So coal is a significant issue up for discussion in the near future, said Mr. Kerry.
China fully understands the challenge of moving away from coal dependency, unabated coal dependency, and trying to harness the best energies of the new energy economy of the future. But that's a big job, and we all understand it.
Both countries are working on finding ways to accelerate that transition away from coal. But the question remains, said Special Envoy Kerry, how do we all help accelerate a transition in a way that doesn't cripple an economy or reduce people's ability to use some of the things they need today? We think there's great opportunity in our doing that together, and that will be part of our conversation going forward. Further engagements, said Mr. Kerry during a press conference, should help unlock more ambition in reducing coal consumption, cutting methane emissions, and beating a path towards a stronger outcome at the 2023 United Nations Climate Change Conference, the COP28.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.